Hi, this is Laura Robson. I'm back with Alfie Hewitt and Jack Draper, celebrating 100 years of Centre Court this summer.
Time.
I hope you're enjoying the series.
The first time I ever played on centre, Federer was walking back up and he just said, good luck, Laura.
I never knew you were such a keno, like
proper tennis nerd.
I'm tennis nuts.
What a point from the teenager, Jack Draper.
Who's the most famous person you've met at Wimbledon?
Bradley Cooper.
Beckham.
Lewis Hamilton.
Justin Timberlake.
Drake was there 1 year as well.
I have to go with the Queen.
Okay.
Yeah.
And feel the connection this summer with Vodafone, official partners of Wimbledon.
Good for the podcast.
This is episode 3, Alfie's Story. We're back with Alfie. Hello, Alfie. Hello, Jack. And Jack, we've got to update someone's bio.
Yeah, exactly. We've got a 20-time Grand Slam champion here with us. How are you, Alfie?
Hi, guys. Yeah, just straight off the plane, pretty much from Paris. Me and Gordon, we managed to win the doubles again, third consecutive time, which also was 10 Grand Slams in a row now for us. So a pretty proud achievement. And didn't have the same luck in the singles, unfortunately, but it was good to end the week on a high.
Number 20, that equals Novak and Roger. Thoughts on that?
Sure, that's the first person that's actually said that. Not quite the same, obviously, the singles and the doubles combined, that is. But the Shingo Kaneda, who's number one at the moment, I think he's on something like 49 Grand Slam titles, singles and doubles combined. So that's the number I'm after at the moment.
Massive congratulations. Great achievement.
Yeah, it's an unbelievable achievement.
Yeah, huge, huge accomplishment.
And we're very proud of you for sure.
Cheers, guys. Rafa, I'm coming for you.
Time. All right, Alfie, this one's all about you.
Hello, Alfie.
Are you ready?
Let's do it.
You guys have actually played together, haven't you? How did that come about?
Yeah, at the end of sort of last year, I did my ankle quite badly and I think I was on crutches at the time. And I saw Alfie and the guys in the lunch hall and I said, look, I'd love to get in a chair at some point and see how tough what you guys do is. I got in the chair. Alfie was on court. I was horrific.
Oh, he was terrible. I mean, I'd seen him play at Queen's last year and people were raving about him. But when I got on court with him, I don't know. It was obviously a different Jack. No hope. To ask for.
After that session, I think I hit the gym for about 2 weeks straight, just trying to improve my ability.
How much you need to work on your upper body.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what, the funniest moment of that, though, was it was me and Lucy Shuka, a women's player, and you'd got on your feet at this point, and we had asked you to hit down one of your fastest serves.
Yeah.
And Lucy being quite, well, we've got restricted mobility, basically. And we said, whatever you do, do not body serve her. And I kid you not, you must have put down, what, 105, 110 miles an hour that absolutely flew past her face.
No.
Like, you must have missed her by a couple of centimetres.
I need to mess you and say sorry for that. I probably can't remember doing
getting
that.
Getting a bit red there.
Yeah, I know. Oh,
brilliant from Hewitt. He generates such speed across the court.
So when I was 7 years old, I got diagnosed with a hip condition called Perthes disease, which basically affects the femur, the top of the femur. So due to like poor blood circulation, the top of the femur started to disintegrate and dissolve. So that's why I then had to become wheelchair bound at a young age. And before that, I was really into my football. Football was like my sport and wanted to become this sort of professional goalkeeper at the time, loved Norwich City. Those are my aspirations in life. And then obviously this random thing, which kind of came out of nowhere, hit me hard. And I think that was a really tough transition. And so I was missing sport basically. And my family could kind of see that I needed a little bit of competition and I missed that side of sport because I wasn't really getting active. And so I remember Stoke Mandeville, it's a big hospital, and they, alongside Wheel Power, were running like these come trial events where you can go and just basically trial lots of different disabled sports. You sort of sign your name up, you go and have a taster, and basically at the end of it, if you liked it, they would they'd kind of give you like contact details to be able to go back to your hometown and continue. And that's really where it all started for me. Picked up a racket, obviously it was absolutely dreadful, but it was something different. And I remember it was tennis, basketball and archery. Those are the three sports that I continued playing for quite a while. And every Wednesday I'd go and join this sort of disability group, and you know, we make friends, families were able to get involved so I could play with my brother, my sister. You know, I wasn't really getting taught tennis. It was just to have a laugh and get out there and be social and be active. And then after like a year or two, it was like, actually, now I want to start taking this up a little bit more seriously. And then got into more training, started to compete and travel, and the rest is sort of history.
So a year in, when you were doing the three sports, but then decided to go into tennis, did you think that you were good at that stage?
No, I didn't. I didn't think so, because I was really enjoying my basketball at the time. So I played for a local team in Norwich, and I think I probably at that time was enjoying the basketball more so, just because it, you know, being at a social team, everyone was my age. Whereas tennis was sort of, you know, go out, get on a court, you're training with maybe one coach or a hitting partner or something. And I don't think at that very young age I preferred it. So yeah, I continued playing those two sports until I was about 15, 16. And it wasn't until I was about 10, 11, 12 where I then was told by the Tennis Foundation at the time that this kid had a bit of potential, and my family pushed me into doing more things, training more, playing more. And I grew to obviously love the game and make a career out of it.
And Alfie, what was the visibility of wheelchair tennis at that time?
I'd say it was pretty invisible compared to what it's like now. I know things have come a long way since I was involved, when I got involved at, you know, 7 years old, which was 13, 14, 15 years ago now. So I think nowadays, if you see a sport, find a sport, want to get involved in the sport, I believe there's actually an app that wheelchair users can go to be able to find if local lessons in your area or what there is actually able to do and access. So, you know, back then it was more sort of word of mouth and a lot less going on. And it was sort of a real tough ask to try and get young kids with disabilities involved, which is why charities like Wheelpower were so powerful back then, because there wasn't many initiatives to get kids involved. Obviously, I was very lucky to hear about this and obviously was able to continue, but I don't think it's half as good as what it is now.
And I remember people like Peter Norfolk. He was always at the NTC when I was a lot younger. Was he someone that you were aware of, or were you ever even able to watch him on TV, or is that just not a thing at the time?
Yeah, he was... He was obviously a legend in our sport. The quad father, they called him. I don't know how many titles he won in the end, but it was
a lot.
It was a lot. I know he won a couple of gold medals, numerous Grand Slam titles. So I actually went to London 2012, and I had the chance to basically watch one sport at the Paralympics, and I chose to watch wheelchair tennis, even though I was sort of involved, but I was still too young at the time to be able to compete. And I remember the first match that I watched was Peter Norfolk. And, you know, everyone obviously idolized him. Everyone knew about Peter Norfolk. And he was a great advocate for our sport. I think he was even the flag bearer that year as well. So, you know, a massive figure within Paralympics and wheelchair tennis.
And how did you afford the kit, the tech stuff?
It's so expensive.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the chair I'm using now, which obviously is bespoke and probably one of the most expensive chairs you can get off RGK, is around £5,000 to £6,000. So they are an expensive bit of kit, which you don't want to go wrong when you're going through the airports and stuff. But, you know, back then it's obviously it's difficult. We didn't really come from a wealthy background as well. So things like, you know, wheelchairs, tennis rackets, tennis lessons, you know, my mum had to dig deep into her pockets and the family had to dig deep into their pockets. I remember her applying for grants to try and get myself a wheelchair when I was seven, eight years old. And the Lord Tavern is a very well-known charity. They helped me out. And I remember I didn't have a sports wheelchair because it's vital. Like, to be able to get into sort of disability sport, you do need that sports wheelchair. and I never had one. I remember my first sessions in tennis, I was in this like standard Red Cross chair that you'd get in the hospital, which is obviously dreadful. Absolutely no movement around the court. I felt like Jack Draper when he was in the chair the other week.
You need the strongest arms in the world to be able to do that.
I was really bad.
You need so much upper body strength.
Yeah, so much upper body strength, which I don't have. and also just, yeah, the skill it requires is massive. So it reminded me how tough something like that is.
What was the hardest thing you found about
just
it?
Just changing direction. Or even just moving quickly out to the ball or something. Like, I think you serve one wide and the chair didn't even move.
I just watched it go by.
Yeah, I was trying, but I'll have to get the video out. But yeah, it was definitely eye-opening.
I know some of the other wheelchair players, like Nico Langman, he's an Austrian player. And when Andy Murray was in Vienna, I think it was, he got on court and hit a few balls with him. I think Gordon and Andy have done like a mixed doubles, one up, one down. I think that was after the Rio Paralympics and a bit of a celebration event up in Scotland. I know Novak's got in a chair in here against Lapo and some of the other guys. So a lot of these players, they are interested. And if you catch them at the right moment, I feel like you can get them in just to give it a go and see what they're like. Because there's nothing more satisfying than watching a good able-bodied tennis player struggle to get a first serve in.
Just struggle to move in general. I think it's quite nice at the LTA that the wheelchair players practice at the same times and use the gym at the same time. So you get more of an awareness, I think, of how difficult it is to even get out there and to be able to play tennis is just another level. So I'm always blown away by the upper body strength, by the core strength. And yeah, I've tried it myself and was a bit like Jack, basically. Just couldn't get anywhere.
Level non-existent.
Let's fast forward to your breakthrough year, 2016, and you win Wimbledon for the first time at 18. Did you feel then like your life was about to change, or how was those sort of 6 months from then on for you?
Yeah, it was a bit surreal. I played Wimbledon 2015 for the first time. I lost, I think it was, because it was only doubles back then, so I think I lost the first match that we played. And then behind the scenes, me and Gordon, we started working together, getting ready for the Paralympics in Rio. And we'd obviously agreed to partner each other at Wimbledon, getting ready for the games. And we played a handful of tournaments together, but not a lot because he was still competing at the Slams and I hadn't qualified for the Slams at that point. I was still like 13th in the world, which was a great achievement for an 18-year-old, but not to play the Slams. So obviously he was given the wild card to play with him. And I just remember it being probably one of the most surreal moments of my career because we played on court 17, and at that point I'd never really played in front of a crowd. And I know court 17 is not center court, but it felt like center court. I remember there was people standing on court 16 on the top tier looking over, and there was like two or three layers to the crowds behind the stands. Like, people were desperate to watch. And like, Claire Borden was sitting there on the side of the court. I think it was live on BBC. So for me at that moment, it was like, wow, like the spotlight was well and truly on our sport. And I actually watched a little bit of the match back the other week. And I remember sitting there watching it, and how on earth did I play so well? Because I get pretty nervous now, like going out there and playing Wimby, because it's obviously an amazing place for us Brits to go and play. But back then, it seemed like I just had this fearlessness where I didn't really appreciate or was aware of what was really going on around me. And I remember coming off court and going through like my Twitter feeds, and there was just so many comments. Like, a lot of people had been watching it. I remember having like 500 followers at the start of that final, and then at the end I was maybe like 2,000-3,000 in, and I was just absolutely mind blown by it all. And the attention that it got. And I think, yeah, that did propel me really into then what was my debut at the Paralympics.
Hi guys, Tim Henman here, interrupting the pod to tell you about an exciting Wimbledon summer as I team up with Vodafone. I can't wait to explore Wimbledon Uncovered in 360, powered by Vodafone and available on wimbledon.com. It's going to transform your Wimbledon experience and make you feel like you're right there on centre court. Look out as well for Play Your Way to Wimbledon, powered by Vodafone, as we support young British tennis talent in partnership with the LTA and Wimbledon. Make sure you follow Vodafone's social channels throughout the summer. But for now, it's back to Laura, Alfie and Jack.
Welcome back. I'm Laura Robson. I'm here with Alfie Hewitt and Jack Draper in association with Vodafone.
Alfie Hewitt adds yet another Grand Slam title to his expanding collection.
So we've talked about your career so far and your experience of wheelchair tennis to this point. What would you say the best slam is? Accessibility, visibility?
I mean, they're all got their pros or positives. Like you take Australia, for example. You had Dylan Alcott out there, who's obviously a massive influencer in Australia in general, let alone just wheelchair tennis. And he was able to play on Rod Laver on some of the nighttime matches, had it live pretty much on the big telly, on the big screen, and loads of fans were there watching him and really exposed the sport. And then you take the recent French experience. I just come back and some of the matches were played on Philippe Chatrier. US Open are doing a great job. Like they've now, I'm hearing rumors, I'm not sure if it's 100% confirmed yet, but I'm hearing rumors that they're extending the wheelchair draw to potentially 16. And those are the real milestones, I think, in terms of looking ahead for our sport. Because an 8-draw is great. It's been like that for a while now. And, you know, we're very lucky to be in everyone with an 8-draw, but I still think the quality and the depth that we can have is easily 12 to 16 players. And, you know, we make a career out of it. It's our jobs, our professions. If you're outside the top eight, you're struggling. So I think the Slams are starting to realize that. And for France, the Roland Garros to be a 16 draw with 12 players was a great starting block. But obviously for me personally, it's got to be Wimbledon. You know, we haven't had the stadium limelights yet, although they did play the women's final on court number one last year, which was groundbreaking. I'd personally love to be able to play on some of the bigger courts. Maybe that's a few years down the line, but that would be the biggest sort of dream for any Brit, let alone a wheelchair player that may not ever thought they could ever get on centre court.
Which of those big courts, like in your own mind, would you love to be on?
You've got to go full out and go centre court, surely. But yeah, we're very lucky. We started off in court 14 and 17. We play most of our matches on those, and then the finals get played on court 3, which with the right scheduling and on the right moment can pretty much draw in a full crowd. Which, you know, I've had some unbelievable matches with Gordon on in the past couple of years, and it's been electric, it's been lively, and I think that's what really gets me excited. If I could play on a bigger court at any stage, center, number two, number one, I'm not picky really, just the more the merrier.
Do you think it's possible on the grass to have all the wheelchair finals on at least court one or ideally center?
It's a difficult question because I don't really know the ins and outs. Obviously, they have their sort of schedule and their traditions around, you know, the mixed doubles or the men's or the women's or the doubles. Like they're very set in stone. And so for us to come in and maybe disrupt that will take a lot. But I think it's possible. I think, first of all, we need to talk about it. We need to make it aware that we're obviously very keen to play on these courts. I think behind the scenes with, you know, sitting down and talking with the directors and the organizers, hopefully that we can come to some arrangement in the future where there can be a slot for a wheelchair match. It's been proven to be able to happen at the other slams. So my question would be why not Wimbledon? Obviously we're a great nation in advocating inclusivity and spreading the messages. And Wimbledon is a great chance to be able to do that when it comes to the disabled world and the bubble that we're in. So hopefully that can be sorted.
Hopefully. We'll start the petition here. Is it something that you guys talk about in the locker rooms?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. it's our dreams to play on this. Like I sit there and I watch all these matches back, and you know, looking at the crowds, like, it doesn't necessarily bring in thousands and thousands of fans whenever we're on these show courts. But to say that you've played on Arthur Ashe, or to say you've played on Philippe Chatrier or Centre Court, that's sort of once in a lifetime memories, really. And you have to pinch yourself a little bit, and it's a little bit surreal when you're looking at these massive stadiums and, you know, wheelchair tennis is being hosted. It's incredible. And I think going back to like the deeper meaning behind it, to be able to have, I think, a wheelchair match on one of those bigger courts, I think it will just show the sort of the inclusivity that as a nation we've strived for since the Paralympics, which obviously was a massive turning point and really kind of showing to everyone that anything's possible.
Incredible from these guys. Gordon Reid and Alfie Hewitt, a 14th Grand Slam title together.
Alfie, what's the future of the tech, and how have the chairs changed, and how are they going to continue to evolve?
Oof. That's a question and a half. It's been a lot of development, I guess, over time. The new thing at the moment is definitely the molded seat. So previously, I'd say maybe looking 10, 15 years ago, you would have your sort of box standard tennis chair that you would adapt maybe the backrest or maybe how high you went, depending on how tall you were and your sort of your needs, really. But now players are looking at it more so from a performance game. One of the French players, Stéphane Houdet, he's got a unique chair. And if anyone ever wants to have a look at it, just it's amazing really what he's done. But he's sort of taken like a bicycle seat stance on it all, rather than having the actual chair and the actual seat to sit on. And he's completely transformed it from that end. You know, I think I heard he spent around 100,000 euros on the research, the material, the design of this chair to be able to come up with something that actually gave him such a gain. So, you know, players are definitely looking at it now. It's not quite Formula One, but, you know, the little margins could be the difference at the end of the day, and whether that be tire pressure or tires or casters, these are all little things that I guess we're starting to look at now.
And for you personally, you've obviously got 20 Grand Slams behind your belt, 4 Wimbledon doubles titles, but no singles final yet. Is that your big goal looking forward, or is that more the Paralympic gold, or are they even in your mind?
I think I've won a lot in my career to date. However, there's still some ones on the bucket list, and whether that be Wimbledon or Australian Open or the Paralympic gold medals, you know, those are all titles and accolades that I'm yet add to the collection. So that's what really drives me. And I think motivation never really is an issue, even with the other slams. And obviously gutted to not defend the singles title in Paris recently. But, you know, to get the chance to come back so soon and play a slam so soon afterwards, and with it being Wimbledon and one that I've never won before, I'm definitely really excited and motivated to do well.
So that's almost it for episode 3. But before we go, if you look at the artwork for this podcast, the image on your phone has a player lying on centre court, holding his face with the crowd on their feet behind him. Who is it? Anyone got any ideas?
Yes, Del Potro.
Duh. What?
Guys, he's in a tennis encyclopedia.
That's Jack, the tennis keynote, with his superior knowledge. You're bringing out a shot as well, forehand line.
Yeah, that's Matt. He beat Ferrer in 4 sets, and he hit like a forehand line, and he was barely moving. It was the quarterfinals.
I think I'd get the fact that it was Del Potro from the tape on his leg and stuff, but that is a joke. You said that so quickly.
I'm going with Jack's answer.
I think the confidence where he said that, we all believe him.
Jack Draper really is a player on the rise.
Thanks for listening to episode 3. Subscribe for a new show every Wednesday in the lead up to Wimbledon.
All good.
Feel the connection this summer with Vodafone, official partner of Wimbledon.